This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to be looking at some new movies that are out this weekend, some comedies, including Entourage, Spy, Insidious Chapter 3, which really isn't a comedy, it's a horror movie. Other horror movies are going to be We Are Still Here and The Nightmare, and then finally Love and Mercy, which is a biopic on the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson. We'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, the box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And of course, you can always reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's jump right into the news. I'm ready to get myself in trouble yet again, and it's always nice that there's news stories coming out that are going to get me in trouble for commenting on, because, you know, the humanity has no shortage of those. But the one, of course, I want to talk about that has been sort of setting the internet on fire this whole week is the whole Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner transition that got debuted, so to speak, in Vanity Fair. Now, gender identity it's an issue for some people. It is. It's a real issue. And it's his issue or her issue. And it's her struggle. And if this brings Caitlyn Jenner peace, who am I to complain? This is her deal right now. So I don't have a problem with the transition going on. Some people do, but you know, you got to get over that. What I'm talking about with the whole Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner thing is I have a hard time getting behind her as a hero. Not because of the transition, because if that's what she needs to do to bring peace to herself, that's what you need to do. Gender identity is a real issue. However, in this whole media circus that's happened, it just seems a little conveniently timed right now with this whole reality show that they're doing. I remember hearing about this when they did the Barbara Walters interview with Bruce Jenner several months ago. In the middle of all the myriad of discussion of gender identity and issues he was facing, he talks about the fact that they're going to do another reality TV show. And like I said, I don't question the transition, but this is coming from the family that does nothing without spinning it into their own narcissism. I mean, after all, didn't the whole Jenner Kardashian reality show empire start with a sex tape? And now Kim Kardashian is being heralded as a role model for young girls? I mean, seriously, people, look at our society. What is happening here with the celebrity worship? And the heart of it are these reality TV show families that feed on this like a vampire. And it also seems to be this entire news story seems to be a bit of a deflection over Jenner's vehicular manslaughter. But whether it's Bruce Jenner or Caitlyn Jenner, the person is still a sleaze, because this is the person who blamed their own negligence, an accidental murder of another motorist, on paparazzi. And that would be one thing if it was just somebody who was embroiled in the paparazzi craze and didn't ask for it. But this entire family feeds on this stuff. This entire family slathers their own personal lives out there on the media. And then when paparazzi follow them, they drive so fast and recklessly, they kill somebody. But no, we don't want to talk about that. Caitlyn Jenner is a murderer. Yeah, accidental, but she's still a murderer. They welcome the attention of the media, and they feed off of it, and they invite it in like a malevolent spirit in some crappy horror movie. And this is what results. This is the life of the American reality TV show family. It's about ratings, and it's about attention. It's not about morality, or doing the right thing, or even being true to yourself. And it cuts both ways along the political issue aisle, because while Jenner is out there deflecting vehicular manslaughter charges and an unlawful death suit with his news stories this week, the Duggars are out there protecting a child molester in their own family who victimized their own family. And people dare to call these family members who are drunk off the glamour role models and heroes? They're not. They're sleazy people who are riding a wave of media popularity. And this is the worst type of person. Because, and you can say, well, what about murders and rapists? Well, there are murders and rapists in these things. There are two families right there. But, you know, back to Jenner and the whole transition from Bruce to Caitlyn in the specific, the whole Vanity Fair cover and the overall support seems so knee-jerk to me. This is nothing against transgender people, because they're real struggles that people deal with. But the message that seems to be coming from this, it has some unintended consequences. And that message is, it's okay to be transgender, as long as you're attractive. Well, have you met any real transgender people? I have. And it's rarely an easy transition. Most transgender people do not have the luxury of tens of thousands of dollars in cosmetic surgery, an Annie Leibovitz photo shoot, oodles of photoshopping done and retouching. I question whether an average 65-year-old transgender man transitioning into a woman would get this kind of support if he didn't end up looking like a Jessica Lange doppelganger. This is the problem with American reality TV shows. It breeds attention whores, and that's what everybody is. And then they just latch on to whatever issue that serves a political purpose. There's no sincerity here. Believe me, if they didn't need another reality TV show to continue their cash cow bandwagon, this whole thing would have happened behind the scenes. And that's what I find so unappealing about it. It exists outside of the transgender issue. It has become about the attention and the glamours and the media circus. Let's transition a little bit into some other stories. One of them is The Rock is going to be in a remake of Big Trouble in Little China. Now, that is the film from 1986, directed by John Carpenter. It's a fantastic movie. It's on Netflix if you want to watch it now and not get it ruined in a remake. He's going to play the Jack Burton character. I mean, this isn't set in stone. This is in talks right now, which was Kurt Russell's character. And the problem is that this movie was so iconic and cool and weird and nifty back then, it's just going to get ruined. Partly because The Rock is not a great actor and he always just kind of plays The Rock. He can't play, a bumbling idiot the way Kurt Russell can. I mean, Kurt Russell has a lot of flexibility from character to character and presence. And while The Rock has presence, he always ends up as being The Rock. And I like The Rock. I just don't think he's good for Big Trouble in Little China. And then finally, the last piece of development news is James Wan, who directed Saw and the original Insidious, is on deck to direct Aquaman. And he's going to apparently supervise the script, which I saw in a press release, which I thought was kind of odd, because don't you think a director should have some sort of control over the script already? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I got two movies to cover really quick. They are essentially the same movie. The first one is Joe Dirt 2, Beautiful Loser. I normally don't cover VOD releases, but this one opens on July 16th on Crackle. And I just find it so interesting because I don't think anyone ever asked for another Joe Dirt movie.
What's going on, man?
Well, I was spinning in a twister, and I must have tumbled through time. I just get stupider. Is this Silvertown? What happened?
JD's got himself in another bind.
Not quite, Termite. I'm running away.
You ain't man enough. You know that, Joe Dirt.
Which way am I going?
Last time he had nothing left to lose. This time.
Dump his body in a trunk, then dump his crazy hair in a different trunk.
He's got tons to lose.
I don't know what else to say. It's a time travel movie. It's trying to do the Austin Powers thing. I don't know how effective it's going to be, but... Again, do I have to watch the first Joe Dirt? That's also on Netflix, by the way. Do I have to watch the first one, though, to get it? Because, I mean, are the nuances of Joe Dirt 2, Beautiful Loser, going to be lost on me? The next one I want to talk about is, like I said, very similar to Joe Dirt 2, and that would be Macbeth, which opens on October 2nd.
All hail Macbeth. All hail. All hail Macbeth, I shall be king.
So foul and fair a day I have not seen.
Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts. Hail, King that shall be.
Duncan comes here tonight. If we should fail...
We'll not fail.
This is, of course, Shakespeare's Macbeth. This isn't Tyler Perry's Macbeth or Nicholas Sparks' Macbeth. This stars Marion Cotillard and Michael Fassbender. It has a great cast. It looks intense. The only Macbeth I've really ever seen, I've never had a chance to actually watch a play of Macbeth, but I did see the Roman Polanski version, which is really dreary and heavy and violent and kind of grimy. But this one looks intense. I'm curious to see it. I hope it's good. We had a big surge of Shakespeare movies a couple years ago with stuff like Coriolanus and The Tempest got remade. So there was a bunch of stuff that came out 3 or 4 years ago. Now they've got another one out. And of course, one of his most well-known plays, So we'll see how that goes in October. And that is it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to get out of trouble and talk movies. I'm going to talk Insidious Chapter 3 and Entourage. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming in from Fat Guys at the Movies. We are getting ready to go into the films, the actual movies themselves, and talk about them. Because, once again, I have gotten in enough trouble by talking about... But I don't do politics on this show. It's not a political show. But when it swerves into the entertainment industry, yeah, I'm going to talk about it. And it's not going to... And you know what? People are not going to agree with me all the time. And so what? These are opinions. And like with the whole business of reality TV shows in sexual impropriety and stuff like that, like with the Duggars, I mean, I have no political dog in that fight. My politics is you don't touch children. You don't. That's my political view. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. You don't do that. And you should be punished for it. And you shouldn't be hiding and protecting it. I don't care whether you're the Duggars or whether you're Woody Allen or whether you're Bill Cosby. I'm pretty confident in those beliefs. Let's talk about Insidious Chapter 3. Set a few years before the first film, this thriller sees a demon latching onto the soul of a high school girl trying to contact her dead mother.
You have to be very careful. If you call out to one of the dead, all of them can hear you.
I don't know what's real, and I don't know what to do to stop it.
What's happening to me?
I had a vision of you. A man couldn't breathe. This entity is very dangerous.
I was a huge fan of the first Insidious, and I am often a fan of James Wan and what he does. He's done some bad movies, like Dead Silence was kind of terrible. But he reinvented horror films back in 2003, I think, with Saw, and then he helped reinvigorate the genre just 5 years ago or so when Insidious came out. And I thought both Saw and Insidious were very different than what you were seeing out there at the time. This is the third chapter in Insidious. It's directed by Lee Wennell, who helped write the other ones, and they've been friends for a while. So Wan is not directing it. It's definitely an Insidious movie. It definitely has that feel. It's a slow burn horror. It uses light and shadow. It relies a little more on the digital trickery than the other two Insidious movies. And one of my problems with the second one, while I didn't think the second movie was great, which Wan did direct, I did respect the fact that he was doing something different. At the end, the big climactic scary ending of the second movie was all taking place in this big white room with bright lights, and it was extremely well, I mean, like overlit, which I thought was a daring choice because mostly horror films are shot in the dark and it's supposed to be creepier that way. And I said, well, that's kind of bold and daring for James Wan to kind of just put it all out there. There's nowhere to hide in shadows when there's that much light. I don't think it was 100% effective, but I thought it was interesting what he did. This one falls into the laws of diminishing returns. It's not as good, and it lacks the nuance and the subliminal elements from the first film, which the second film kind of did as well. But the first film, there's a lot going on in the background of the first Insidious. I mean, if you look at like the design of even the sets and where things are and how things are placed behind them, there's a lot of little things you'll notice in the background. Images of eyes in the background. You see, and when they're talking about demons, you see the background, they'll cut away and the background will change. It'll be something different that looks even creepier. There's a lot of that. You don't have any of that in this movie. This one's very straightforward. And the biggest problem with this one, while it has some great jump scares, because it's an Insidious movie, it's not hard to do jump scares. And I like Lynn Shay's character. She's kind of the main character's exorcist, so to speak. She's not really an exorcist. She's a medium. But I just didn't really care about the people. I mean, I like Lynn Shay's character, and they have Specs and Tucker from the previous film show up again. And they're funny, but not nearly as entertaining as they are in the other movies. the girl, she's cute. She looks too young. She looks like she's 15 and she's playing a girl getting ready to go to college. She's fine, but there's nothing to her. There's really no depth to her character. She's very cardboard, very rote. Dermot Mulroney plays the father and he's fine. And then they got a son. I don't know who plays him. But what's so funny, because he disappears after the first or second scene. And then he shows up halfway through the movie. And I'm like, oh my God, yeah, he had a son. The main characters, I didn't care about them. And it's not that I want to see anything bad happen to them. But there was no like emotional investment to the scary stuff that was happening to them. And then when Lin Shaye was in there as Elise, there was no emotional investment to her being in danger because she knows she doesn't die because she's in the first Insidious, which takes place after this one. So there's no danger in this. There's nothing that's really in jeopardy. And so it was fine for what it is. Maybe a watch on Netflix. But overall, I kind of have to say that Insidious Chapter 3 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Entourage. The HBO series about a group of guys from New York making it big in Hollywood comes to the big screen.
Vinny Chase.
Ari Gold.
I hear you got something for me.
My first movie is Studio Head, and boom, I want you to star in it.
Whatever I do next, I also want to direct.
Does he even know how to direct?
If this movie tanks, Vince will not come back from this. Neither will I, and neither will you.
This could get ugly.
Trust me, it's all good.
What's wrong?
We got a sex tape.
Oh, God.
I'm getting married.
Oh, God.
We need more money. Bye.
Oh, God.
I've never watched the show. And that's important because, plain and simple, if you like the show, you're probably going to love this movie. Now, this is not like Chinatown, where it's expertly written and this very dense storyline or anything like that. I mean, you can go in and watch Entourage and never have seen an episode and you're going to pick it up because really it's just a bunch of buffoons making it big in Hollywood. Well, one of them making it big and everybody's still latching onto him. It has some funny moments, but I wouldn't say it's for anybody but fans of the show. The trailer looked funny. The trailer plays funny, but the overall show, it has some funny moments, but it just doesn't hold together. And it seems very random at times. It's got Ronda Rousey in it, who's like the big hot thing now. And look, I don't doubt that Ronda Rousey could beat the crap out of me unless she was acting like she was beating the crap out of me, because she can't act at all. I mean, she is bad. And I don't care if she hears me say it. I'm sure she'd punch me out because that's how Ronda Rousey handles problems in the media, apparently. But she is so terrible in this movie. And she's not even just a cameo. She's kind of a supporting character in it. And I've seen Expendables 3. I've seen the literally two lines she had in like Furious 7. She's a great fighter and she looks pretty cool, but boy, she is a terrible actor. And so, yeah, I mean, Entourage has all these cameos in it. I mean, a lot of them are like one line walk-ons. And I guess that's a bit of a thing that comes from the show itself. You're going to see callbacks, you're going to see everything, but it's made for the fan. Other than that, it's just a bunch of jerks. And the reality is, everyone's kind of a D-bag in this movie. I mean, everybody. There's like no nice person. And I mean, they're supposed to be lovable buffoons. I mean, I just don't get into it. Like, I'll watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia on FXX. And I think that show's funny. And that is just a bunch of buffoons. And they're not lovable buffoons, but it's just fun to watch bad things happen to them. But this is the Three Stooges thing. Now, what's funny is, of course, there now has to be a social issue attached to every movie that's out. And a lot of people are complaining that this reeks of privilege in Hollywood. And I'm like, this is Entourage. I mean, it'd be one thing if it was like The Player, which was a movie from 25 years ago. An excellent movie, by the way, that looked at the internal workings of Hollywood. But it's Entourage. They're a bunch of D-bags anyways. That would be like complaining that The Three Stooges was a sexist bit. Yeah, it was, but that was kind of the point. I mean, Entourage is nothing but a male fantasy of what Hollywood would be like if you made it big. It's not real. It's an exaggerated version. So don't start applying worries about privilege and what this is going to do to society to Entourage. I had somebody ask me if they should go see it, a radio host. And I said, well, it depends on if you like the series or not. If you did, go see it. But it also depends on your level of dealing with D-bags, not just in the movie, but in the audience, because there's a lot of D-bags who are going to go see this because they idolize the guys in the movie unironically. And if you are okay with both of that, then go see the movie. Otherwise, yeah, I have to say it just kind of sucks because it's just not for me because I didn't watch the show.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for this segment. Next, we're going to be talking about the movies Spy and Love and Mercy.
Shake that.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Continue with our movie reviews. Let's talk about the comedy of the week, or the other comedy of the week. That would be Spy. Melissa McCarthy plays a mousy CIA desk agent who gets sent into the field to find a hijacked nuclear bomb after the identities of the rest of the field agents are compromised.
When I joined the CIA, I thought I was going to be this amazing spy. I'm just the same boring person I was before.
You play it too safe.
I just hear my mom's voice. Give up on your dreams, Susan. Just write that in my lunchbox.
Raina Boyanov is about to sell a tactical nuclear weapon to a terrorist organization.
I told you to send me in there.
You can't. She knows the identity of all our agents. We need someone to find the bomb without being detected.
I'll do it.
Okay, thanks, lunch lady.
You're going.
Okay.
Yeah, bring one of your cats as a sidekick.
I don't have cats.
This is directed by Paul Feig. And while I've generally enjoyed the stuff that he does on TV, I think he did like Office episodes and stuff like that, because you have to adhere to a set format on television, which is why all the episodes of a TV show feel the same, even though directed by different directors. And that's why when the directors then leap into the big screen and do their own movie, they have a lot more malleability with the look and the feel and the delivery of the movie. But Paul Feig, I've just not liked his movies. I did not like Bridesmaids, which of course everybody else did, but I did not like it. A lot of it had to do with some of Judd Apatow's influence, because he's worn thin on me. But I also seriously hated The Heat. Now, I know those both got critical acclaim, and I know both of those are big movies, and I know both of those films were ones that people thought were great and put Melissa McCarthy on the map, and that's good for her, because I like Melissa McCarthy, but I was just getting so sick and tired of seeing Melissa McCarthy playing the same Dosh Gunn character over and over and over and over again. She was okay in Bridesmaids, but she was a small part in Bridesmaids. It was the other characters I really didn't like. But The Heat was just her just yelling and screaming, just being foul-mouthed and obnoxious. And Identity Thief, she was just being foul-mouthed and obnoxious. All those movies boiled down to, oh, look at the fat lady swear, which seemed to be the go-to delivery for Melissa McCarthy. And I've been saying for years that I'd like to see her do something different. I'd like to see, because she's got some serious comedy chops. And I became a fan of hers watching Samantha Who. Samantha Who was this little TV show with Christina Applegate, who got amnesia, and her friend was played by Melissa McCarthy, and she was not the character from The Heat. She was the very sweet little nerdy friend, and I thought she was very funny in that, and I like Melissa McCarthy a lot, so I always said I'd like to see her play outside of that wheelhouse. Well, finally she has, and even though Paul Feig, who's responsible for those other two movies, directed this film, I like the heck out of this movie. And all hinges on two things. First of all, it's a spoof of a spy movie. Any good spoof of a spy movie also has to work as a spy movie. You can really push the boundaries, like with the Austin Powers films, but there's still a story to those. And that's why the second movie is kind of not as good, because the second movie has just a terrible MacGuffin to get them through. It did really work on gags alone, but you know, you have to kind of adhere to the rules of a spy movie. You know, some of the Johnny English movies are good, but you can't abandon the spy feel of a movie without abandoning part of what the film is. And that's what the spy actually works, because it feels like a real international thriller. It has like helicopter chases and a motorcycle chase through the streets. It has gunplay. It has hand-to-hand combat, that kind of stuff. So it kind of works as a spy movie. Just as like Beverly Hills Cop is a good cop movie. It's a great comedy, but it's also a good cop movie. It maybe falls a little bit in cliche, but you can do that. You have a little more leeway because you get the comedy. So Melissa McCarthy is the other reason it works. Not only does it work as a spy movie, but she's great in the role. She does something different, and it's got more levels, because she is this mousy, quiet, sweet Samantha Who character. And when you dig down, there's other parts of her get revealed, and she does have the ability to really kick some butt. But you have to see that evolve in her, and I think that worked great. Now, it's rated R, so it has raunchy comedy to it. It has foul language in it. but it doesn't feel like it had a one-note joke that just started at the beginning and just they never changed, which is basically what they did with The Heat. The Heat was just one joke with her being foul-mouthed in it. Foul-mouthed and fat, and that is how they—that's how they handled it in The Heat and Identity Thief, which wasn't directed by Paul Feig. But this one, you know, that was—I thought it was great. They didn't do fat jokes in this movie. I it was after I saw the film, and I'm leaving. I'm talking to my son, who I took. I'm like, they didn't really do fat jokes in this, did they? I'm like, no, I don't remember. Which is good because let's get past that because she's far funnier of a person than to just rely on her weight. And I mean, they rely on her being, you know, maybe, you know, she's not the tall, leggy, gorgeous woman. Like, Rose Byrne is the bad guy in this. And that's what Rose Byrne, well, she's tall compared to Melissa McCarthy because she's like 4 foot. But, because Rose Byrne isn't terribly tall. But, you know, they have that contrast there, but they never go for the cheap joke. And I thought that, well, they go for a lot of other cheap jokes, but they don't go for that cheap joke. And I think it's funny. It has a great cast. I mean, Jason Statham's great playing a caricature of himself. And you've got Jude Law again, kind of playing a caricature of himself. But they all work because you could see Jude Law in a spy movie. You've seen Jason Statham in spy movies. You know, it works. It works for what it is. And I thought that was very funny, surprisingly funny. Actually had me laugh out loud quite a few times. Stay till after the credits because it has a really funny scene. And I got to say, this is one of the biggest surprises so far this year. I think that Spy totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on and talk about Love and Mercy. The life, music, and mental struggles of Beach Boy Brian Wilson is examined in this biopic. I'm picking up
good vibrations. If you want to continue to see him, you should know.
Brian is a very, very sick man.
And your voices. I didn't tell you that. I didn't want to scare you away.
The talking in your head, that's part of the song?
Jesus Christ.
It's part of the music.
You are not hungry. You think you're hungry. Stop!
Stop! This is one of those movies, kind of like when I was talking about Insidious Chapter 2 earlier in the show, where I may not have particularly liked it, but I respect what it was trying to do. And I know this movie is getting tons of great reviews. I'm just going to put that out there. So you may not want to listen to what I say on this. Of course you do. You want to know what I have to say because everything, every word, every utterance, every burp and weird noise that comes out of my mouth is a gem of genius and wisdom. So yes, please stick around and listen to what I have to say about this film. But it is getting good reviews from other people. They're praising the content. They're praising the acting. Now, I appreciate what they were doing because this is not your typical biopic. Your typical biopic ends up being struggles from them being a kid to growing up, becoming famous, dealing with drugs and dealing with this. And well, you see that in Ray. You see that with Walk the Line. Those are good movies, but they're very typical standard biopics. This movie takes it from a different approach. It has two different time frames. One of them is in the 60s, and Brian Wilson was played by Paul Dano. And then he got him in the 80s, where Brian Wilson is dealing with a lot more than just music. He's dealing with mental illness, and he's dealing with drug abuse, and he's dealing with oppressive people who are controlling him. And so you got the struggling Brian Wilson 20 years later in the 80s. And he's played by John Cusack there. And while they both do a decent job, I think Paul Dano really brings a character a little more uniqueness. I just don't buy John Cusack as an older version of Paul Dano. I mean, I could buy him as Brian Wilson, kind of, sort of. I mean, not really, but he does an okay job delivering his lines, we'll say. But I don't see them as being held together very well. They don't bridge the story because they are very different in their approach and their looks and their feel. But what it does is it takes sort of this docudrama approach to especially the 1960s scenes. It just kind of shows the story going back and forth between before he had all these problems and then in the midst of dealing with all this. And I respect that. I didn't particularly like it. I also feel it falls into violating the show don't tell rule. In both writing and movie making, you want to show the things. You want to see things happen. And you don't really see a whole lot happen in these movies. And most of it is relayed by conversations with each other. And that's the trappings of this setup because but you see him in early in his career before his downfall, and then you see him at the lowest point, but you don't see where he went there. And I know they did that purposely didn't show that because that was a different structure, which, like I said, I respected the structure, but I don't think it quite worked because then you just have people talking about what happened a couple of years ago. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, God, that would have been a neat scene to see. So while I did not particularly like the movie, I thought it was unique enough and different enough. And I also didn't know this about Brian Wilson. I was a huge Beach Boys fan growing up, but it was all the classic recordings from the 60s. So I didn't know this about him. So it was an eye-opening experience and interesting to watch. But yeah, like I said, I still overall, I just wasn't a fan. I have to say this one kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies, and I need to leave and make some money with important commercial interruptions. But when I come back, I'm going to be talking about two more movies, horror films, The Nightmare, and We Are Still Here. And then, of course, the box office and the world-famous DVD roundup. We'll see you on the other side.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I am not leaving you alone without hearing the last pearls of wisdom from me. I've got two more movies to talk about. They're both horror. Oh, I said they're both horror movies. One of them's a documentary, but it's a scary documentary. But I want to jump right into these because these are worth checking out. They're both available in limited release and I believe on demand now. So even if you don't live near where a theater is, you can go check them out online in your various on-demand services. The first one I want to talk about is The Nightmare. The director of Room 237 takes a look at the terrifying reality of sleep paralysis.
I had zero control over my body. Like, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't move my arms, my legs.
I began hearing voices and screams and crying. I would hear all the sounds of hell. And that is when the Shadow Man would come.
It's a kind of horror that is worse than, like, in the movies.
You are going to die.
This movie has an interesting approach to the documentary style because it's a documentary. It's people being interviewed and examining a topic. But it does so by shooting it like a horror movie. And that, I think, is a really innovative way of doing it. Now, in terms of the information you get from it, as they have these people talking about what they're encountering when they sleep, immediately I remember thinking, oh, this is sleep paralysis. If you don't know what sleep paralysis is, it happens when you sleep, your body releases chemicals, especially when you dream. So like the idea that you're running when you're dreaming, like you see a dog kicking its legs when, oh, it's dreaming. No, they're not, because the body actually releases chemicals that causes you to be paralyzed. And that's so you're not flailing around when you're dreaming. It's an evolutionary response, because the last thing you want to do is be in your most vulnerable position and be kicking around and yelling and screaming and then have predators come up and be like, well, there he is. Let me eat this guy. So there's a scientific reason for sleep paralysis. But what happens is some people don't completely go under immediately. Their mind doesn't go unconscious and doesn't go into that dream state at the same time. It just doesn't time out right. Or they wake up from it. And everybody's encountered sleep paralysis before. I've had it a couple times where, in particular, you wake up and you're struggling to open your eyes, but you can't move because your body is flush with this chemical that keeps you paralyzed. And eventually it works its way out of the system and you can wake up. But if you don't know what it is and you start having hallucinations and basically dream images, it can be really freaking terrifying. But of course, it's not good for a thriller horror movie type thing to just say, well, this is it and this is the scientific reason for it. I mean, they throw that out there, but they want to scare you with this. And they, of course, the people that are experiencing the sleep paralysis, they poo-poo the idea of just being such a simple explanation. And of course they would, because the most vulnerable position you're ever going to be in is when you're sleeping. You're unconscious. You are completely exposed. And when something seems to be invading your sleep, you don't want to just brush it off as, oh, it's a chemical reaction in your brain. But it really shows some great imagery in some of these stories that people tell. And there are chilling things. And you may actually lay down and have sleep paralysis nightmares during it, which is really kind of cool. It's an effective movie. But it is directed by the guy who did Room 237. So similar to 237, which had such great theories of the Shining. And what 237 did, even if you think all the theories are bunk, it challenged you to watch The Shining differently. And The Nightmare is similar, because you'll be challenged to think about your dreaming and you'll be scared to actually experience these imagery, which you might, because you're very open to suggestion in sleep. But also, like 237, at certain points, the people then go off the rails, and you're watching the interview subjects in this movie, and there's like two of them where I'm just like, oh yeah, these people are kind of nuts. These people have severe issues because of it might be stemming from sleep paralysis and nightmares, but they have trouble separating some reality there. But it's still, it's an interesting movie, and it's creepy and it's scary. Watch with the lights off. I dare you. So I'm going to say The Nightmare kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The next one I want to talk about is We Are Still Here. After the death of their son, an older couple find themselves haunted by vengeful spirits.
We heard it was a funeral parlor around the turn of the century.
Old Dagmar had been running the bodies and burying empty coffins. Wasn't long after that the trouble began. You're not leaving here. Don't fight it. Just accept it. You stay, you satisfy the darkness.
In my mind, I take it as a companion piece to Your Next, which is a horror film that came out a couple years ago, which is a fantastic horror film. Deconstructs the home invasion genre incredibly well. The reason I pair it with that is because it stars Barbara Crampton, who I love. And I loved her back when she was doing Stuart Gordon's H.P. Lovecraft movies like From Beyond and Reanimator in the 80s. And she's kind of come back and doing some good horror movies now. And so she did Your Next, and she's in this one as well. And there's another guy who's from Your Next in this one. And it has a similar feel because it's going to this deserted house in the middle of nowhere and bad things are happening. It's not the same people doing it, but it just feels like it's cut from the same cloth. And I'll tell you, We Are Still Here has some great moments to it. It has some very scary scenes. It has some very effective gore. If you love gore, if you're a gore hound, you're going to love this movie because there's just over the top crazy stuff happening at times. And it is a slow burn, but it's not disappointing. It's not as nuanced and it's not as smooth as something like Your Next or something like It Follows, which was another very slickly suspenseful film that came out recently. But We Are Still Here still totally works. And it's worth seeing, especially for horror movie fans, haunted house movie fans, and you get to see some cool stuff. And, you know, it's an hour and a half. You're in and you're out, and it works for what it is. And I enjoyed it. So I'm going to have to say We Are Still Here kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let me roll into the box office here. And this is where I was wrong with one, but I was dead on with another. I said, well, I wasn't terribly wrong. I said San Andreas was going to win. I predicted $39 million. And some people thought that was high for me to suggest that. San Andreas actually made almost $55 million. That's way beyond what anyone was predicting. Now, I've certain people say, well, this is the first bona fide hit from The Rock. I'm like, well, not really. The Rock has had plenty of hits. I mean, he had the whole Scorpion King stuff. And he's been in movies. He's just never been the single person draw for a film. I think he works in the right roles, but the Rock is appealing, but I don't necessarily think he can't play an everyman. But in this one, he's not shirtless. He's just the rescue guy, and they minimize his big bulky muscles. Plus, it was a spectacle, and it was kind of the movie of the weekend. Then there was Aloha, which came in sixth. I remember saying, it's not even going to make $10 million. And I was absolutely right. It made $9.67 million, which is terrible for a Cameron Crowe movie. And of course, people are still going off on the whole whitewashing of it because Emma Stone was cast as a girl who's supposed to be half Hawaiian, like a quarter Chinese, and she's nowhere near Asian. But look, if your problem with Aloha is the whitewash casting of one character, you didn't see the movie because there's a long, long list of reasons why Aloha was a failure of a film. This week, I think that Spy's going to win, actually. Entourage, some people have a lot of buzz for Entourage, but I think it's going to be front-loaded because of the fans coming out, and most of the audience, since it opened on Wednesday, will have seen it. The diehard fans will have seen it Wednesday and Thursday. Insidious, I think, is going to be okay, but summer's not a great time to release a movie like this. This is a much more of a September release. So I'm going to say $55 million for Spy. I think Spy's going to click, partly because people like Melissa McCarthy. They see her movies. People like Paul Feig. He's had a couple big hits with her. The biggest thing that it has going against it is the R rating. Paul Feig's done R-rated films and done very well with them. So I think $55 million for Spy. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. couple ones I want to highlight. The first one on the list is Jupiter Ascending. This, like Tomorrowland, I think was unfairly maligned by critics and audiences, and I thought it was very original and very different. I love the Wachowskis. I rewatched this, and yeah, there's some goofy things that happen. But the Wachowskis do such a great job with the action, and they are so vibrant and so innovative with some of the choices that they make. It's definitely worth seeing. And people complain about there not being enough original movies. Well, go see the movies that are original. Even if you don't love them, support the ones that are different. So go rent Jupiter Ascending if you haven't seen it. There's also Parks and Recreation Season 7. That's the final season of the show. It's very funny. Chris Pratt ending just in time before he launches off into full-fledged movie stardom because he's got Jurassic World coming out next week. Then there's the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, which was surprisingly way better than I thought it would be. It was fun. I took my 7-year-old, and we had a blast. It was neat seeing it because I was in a room of college students, and it was me and him with college students, and all the college students remember watching SpongeBob when they were his age. And so it was this weird kismet. McFarland USA, which is, again, a surprisingly well-done movie based on a true story. Kevin Costner coaching a cross-country team in the Southwest. And then, of course, Focus, which wasn't my favorite movie out of all of them. It was a big one because it had Will Smith and Margot Robbie, but I just thought it was okay. The stinger of the week is the Tom and Cherry Gene Deitch collection. If you don't know who Gene Deitch is, he made these weird, surreal, bizarre, bonkers Tom and Jerry cartoons in the 60s that are completely inconsistent with anything else from Tom and Jerry. They're fascinating to watch, but they're also quite terrible and insane. I have this picture of Gene Deitch directing them, sitting with a straight jacket, eating flies, throwing his own feces against the wall as he directs these movies, because that is what these short films are like. So I guess it's a stinker, but it's also a fascinating look at entertainment history. That's it for me. I need to leave you guys for another week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Jurassic World and Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. That's all one movie. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.